From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Police arrest hundreds as protests against use of force play out across Michigan.
People are being handcuffed. They're being physically assaulted. They're being herded onto buses. Some people for upwards of 3 to 4 hours at a time.
Also, One City's poet laureate frames the protest through long and painful experience.
We are creating a social time bomb that is ready to explode. You see, in Grand Rapids, we live in an echo chamber.
Elsewhere, COVID infections are waning, but the insomnia and flashbacks are just beginning for hospital workers.
A lot of them are also saying that they are experiencing headaches, anxiety, depression, loss of focus.
We'll talk about what can be done in a field that already experiences intense mental health consequences. Those stories and more coming up on today's Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we'll look into what happens to the people arrested in Michigan protests over the past couple of days. To hear advocates tell it, due process has been hard to find.
I've been a civil rights lawyer since 1982, and I have seen a lot of police misconduct in my time, and I have rarely seen anything as blatantly unconstitutional as what I've been seeing out on the streets these past 5 days.
More on that story later in the hour. But first, the novel coronavirus's grip on Michigan has loosened in recent weeks. On Tuesday, did you know Michigan recorded just 199 new cases? That's pretty low considering how things have been lately. But as frontline workers emerge from months of almost warlike chaos, clinicians are noticing a massive surge in mental health needs among a traumatized workforce. Michigan Radio's Kate Wells and Kelly House of Bridge Magazine are co-reporting on this, and they're here to tell us about what's happening. Ladies, welcome back to Stateside.
Hey, April.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kate, I know you've been talking with doctors and nurses about this. What do some of them say they're experiencing?
Yeah, so like you mentioned, you know, kind of that focus and adrenaline of the initial surge are fading, and that is bringing some sense of relief for a lot of them. But a lot of them are also saying that they are experiencing insomnia right now, headaches, intense flashbacks, anxiety, depression, loss of focus. One of the nurses that I talked to, she works the night shift at a COVID unit in a Beaumont hospital. She didn't have permission to talk to the media, so we're just not going to use her name. And she was telling me about this one day where she just crashed and she slept for like 16 hours straight. And she wakes up because her husband is shaking her and he says, I think you're wrestling with some PTSD, because she had been screaming out in her sleep.
I can't even remember what the dream was about, but it was so real at that moment that he like woke me up, because I guess I was like screaming in my sleep.
And lately, since then, she has been actually struggling with not being able to sleep at all. And that's making it hard for her to focus on her kids. And every time she tries to go to sleep, she says, you know, she just lays there and runs through this loop of anxieties. What if she dies? What if her kids get sick? And the other thing that is really having an impact on her life right now is she's having these flashbacks to when things were really bad at her hospital, and she was the only one in the room with patients when they were dying. You know, she would hold their hands, she would pray with them, she would hold up iPads so they could talk to their families. But she felt like that was the most heartbreaking part for her, and she's really still intensely experiencing that.
That's just awful. Kelly, you've been talking with health systems and experts in the field, and obviously trauma is not a new thing in the medical field. There are people who've served in war zones or on relief missions. What are they seeing now that's different in terms of who's seeking help and what they need?
Well, yeah, as you said, trauma is not a new thing. But for many of these people, you know, you think about first responders, doctors, nurses, staff in hospitals, and oftentimes they know what they're going into. It may be a traumatic situation, but they have a sense of what to expect, and they address the issue, you know, an emergency accident on the highway that you're picking up victims from, a surgery that is, you know, really intense, and then they move on. With COVID-19, because it is this prolonged thing that no one has, you know, any experience with and no one expected, what I heard from experts is that it is both this acute and chronic trauma that, you know, hospital workers just have not been used to or trained to deal with. And then on top of this, They're going home to their family and wondering if they'll get them sick. There is no relief in either their professional or personal life, which I think has just made what previously may have been manageable trauma that's part of the job now something that is harder to manage.
I mean, I know a lot of medical professionals really pride themselves as being able to handle it, you know, and just deal with it because it's part of the job.
Exactly. Yeah, this is a field with sort of a culture of stoicism, is what one expert told me. But I think, you know, priding yourselves on handling it, we also have a lot of stats that show there are already high suicide rates, high burnout rates in this profession that likely come from the intensity and the trauma. So this was always there, maybe less understood and spoken about, but the COVID-19 crisis has really brought it to the forefront, and there is a pretty high recognition amongst hospital leaders and, you know, leaders in the frontline fields in general that this trauma is going to be bubbling to the surface and need to be grappled with.
I know that there was a pretty high-profile example of this in New York City in April. There was a doctor who was an emergency department medical director who was treating people at New York Presbyterian Allen who died by suicide. Mm. Do we know if anything like that has happened here?
There have not been any, publicized cases of suicide stemming from COVID-19 experiences for frontline workers, but the experts we've talked to certainly said they anticipate an uptick in suicide, post-traumatic stress disorder, anxiety, other mental health conditions among frontline workers. And people who run hotlines and support groups that have sort of cropped up to deal with that trauma tell us that they're already seeing a surge in demand for their services from traumatized frontline workers. Even grocery store workers, you know, so this is not limited to hospitals.
What do we know about what is being provided to these workers through their employers right now?
So, you know, it varies a little bit from system to system. Kate and I sort of did a survey of a lot of the bigger systems in the state, and there was everything from hotlines and yoga classes, meditation sessions, Zoom-based, you know, online therapy sessions, because we are still dealing with the era of social distancing, you know, Zen dens where hospital staff can go and sort of take a load off. But hospital systems also sort of recognize that in the past, they have not done a good job, by and large, of addressing worker trauma. Both hospital leaders and doctors and nurses we talked to noted that sometimes it has in the past amounted to, you know, here's a card with a number to call if you're traumatized, or here are ways to practice meditation. That's not going to cut it in a situation like this.
Hey, Kate, I know you talked to a couple of people who are trying to change the mental health response where they work. Can you walk us through the approaches that they're taking?
Yeah, so a couple of things. I mean, you mentioned, Kelly mentioned that like the old way of doing this is not going to cut it this time around. One example of the way people are trying to change that, actually where they themselves work, is over at McLaren Hospital in Flint. There's this clinical health psychologist there. Her name is Nicole Franklin, and she was actually repurposed to the hospital to provide psychological first aid, as she calls it, to frontline workers. And so she could have like given out her card or said, here's the hotline number. But she actually started doing the work that these physicians and nurses were already doing. Like she started treating COVID patients. She started, you know, doing mental health work right along those doctors and nurses. And it not only got them to trust her, she says, it also got them to the point where when they had a crisis, she was right there. They didn't have to go anywhere. She knew them and she could just respond in the moment on the job.
So that while they were coming out of a room after losing a patient or making a phone call to a family member that was difficult, I was there to provide them with support, techniques, help walk them through that. And when they started realizing the benefit of it, then they began to be more willing to participate.
And so from there, she could kind of be like, hey, you should join the support group. You should see a counselor, et cetera. I want to note, though, that she didn't do this by herself. She teamed up with somebody who had a longstanding relationship with those nurses. Her name's Amy Maya. She's a nurse educator. She says, like, I can look at these nurses and just know sort of like when your mom looks at you, when you're having a hard time. And the two of them would approach people on the job in person. And that is going to be such an important part of this, that you really build this kind of response into the job itself rather than waiting for healthcare workers to come to you. Maya says, though, that, you know, even the people providing this, they're not exempt from this kind of struggle themselves. You know, she lost colleagues to COVID. She hasn't seen her kids in months. She broke down talking about like finally getting to hug them on Mother's Day. And she says, you know, she had to like practice what she was preaching.
Honestly, I sought mental health treatment. I finally broke down and called my doctor and said, listen, I'm going to need a little support through this.
Wow. Kelly, it sounds like whatever effort is put into place to help these workers, it's not just going to be a thing for a couple of weeks or a couple of months.
No, you know, there's a reason they call it post-traumatic stress disorder, and that is that for many of these people, symptoms may not even be showing up now, although we have, as we have heard already, they are for many. But this is something that will linger. It is likely to continue to emerge as people have time to stop and process what just happened in their workplaces and the trauma they just went through. And sort of the overarching message that we heard from mental health experts was this is going to be a long-term need that health systems and other frontline employers need to keep in mind and address. And ultimately, particularly in healthcare, where we do have sort of this culture of silence and self-reliance, it's going to require institutional change that breaks through that culture. And hospitals should be thinking about bigger cultural changes that will make their workers feel comfortable acknowledging and seeking help for the trauma that they're experiencing right now.
You know, it almost sounds like some of the things the military has put into place in the wake of the wars of Iraq and Afghanistan. Ladies, thank you very much for your reporting on this. We've been speaking with Bridge Magazine's Kelly House and Kate Wells of Michigan Radio. Thank you both very much for reporting on this. We appreciate it.
Thanks, April.
Thank you.
Michigan's kids would normally be gearing up for summer camp right about now. There may have never been more of a need for the camp experience.
You know, kids just really need for their social and emotional and mental health to be out and gathering and connecting.
But so much remains to be decided about how camps will work this summer. We'll speak with two camp directors in just a moment. That's after the break. Stay with us. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. For months now, summer camps, not to mention campers, have been in limbo. Will there be swimming, archery, horseback riding, crafts and canoeing? S'mores with songs by the campfire? Will there even be camp this year? Things are starting to look a little clearer, at least for Michigan's day camps. Governor Whitmer lifted the stay-at-home order on Monday, and in doing so, she also announced day camps will be allowed to open starting next week. So what does a day at camp look like amid the pandemic? Dave Morgan is the CEO of the YMCA of Greater Kalamazoo, and he's agreed to come talk to us about this. Dave, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Tell us what the last couple of months have looked like.
Well, it's been different. I will tell you, you know, I think that we've been learning as we go. What I always tell people is the one thing I've learned is the only wrong decision I make is the one that I don't make. Meaning that it is just changing all the time. So we just have to be prepared and go with whatever the best information we have at that moment and then adapt it as things change.
You're already offering childcare for essential workers in the greater Kalamazoo community. Have you learned anything through that process about how you might be able to run summer camps safely?
Yeah, you know, we have. I think along the way, what we've done is we've learned the safety protocols we follow along what were developed through the CDC and others regarding masks at all times for our employees, hand washing. We limiting our program space to small numbers, no more than 10 kids in a group, keeping them isolated from each other. You know, I think that there's been some good and bad in that. And we'll, as we talk about camp a little bit, is, you know, the kids don't get the exposure to the large group that they normally would. And so you don't get to develop the large group of friendships. But we've kind of looked at it as quality instead of quantity now. And really, as these small groups really engage with each other on a daily basis, that they get to know their staff, because the staff don't turn over like they normally might, because we try to keep staff somewhat socially isolated with each group. Mm-hmm. So I think we've really learned to manage as we go. The kids are still having a great experience. It's not the one that they are maybe used to, but we have learned a lot along the way.
Can you break down your budget for us a little bit? I mean, what is the income makeup for day camps?
Well, that's probably the biggest challenge. Well, one thing we've learned is, with the staff ratios that we're doing, which is a one staff per every five children, there's no money to be made in the world of childcare or even camp this summer. We're doing it because we know it's an obligation or responsibility we have for our community to support our healthcare workers and our grocery store employees and our police officers and firefighters and those that are doing some really heavy lifting for our community. As we go into this, obviously we've gotten some support and we continue to get some support from our donors, our members, our sponsors. But as far as the revenue generated from childcare, simply put, there's no money to be made in childcare at this point.
Let's talk about shifting into gear for summer. Did you have any advance warning that the governor was going to lift restrictions on day camps?
Well, so we have been preparing all along that would be the case. And, as we look at camp, obviously we want the kids to have that experience. But we also understand the value it brings because the economy begins to open. People are going back to work. There's a need for camp and childcare services for families, and that's only going to expand. We also, our biggest concern was we serve some of the most vulnerable neighborhoods along the north side of and east of Kalamazoo. And a number of our kids, this is an important educational component to them, so they don't see that summer slide. And so we wanted to make sure that we were giving them that experience so that as they prepare for school in the fall, they're ready.
You mentioned the size of the groups. Are there other ways in which day camp activities will be changing? I mean, everybody seems to want to know about swimming pools first and foremost.
Well, for us, that camp experience is obviously going to be different. The smaller groups don't allow for big game play and some of the activities that the kids are used to. Swimming is still a little bit up in the air. Most of our kids swim indoors normally for our summer camp because our camps are city based and near our YMCA facilities and so the pools aren't going to be opened at this point. But we'll continue to do many of the same activities that they're used to. Again, they're going to have their daily transitions from dramatic play to STEM activities, physical activities, dramatic play. All of that will continue on, and the staff will make sure that the kids have that special experience. We want the kids to be able to return to some sense of normalcy best that they can. But again, things like field trips are going to be eliminated for this summer for us anyway, because the bus transportation is challenging. Socially distancing on a bus is a challenge, and doing large groups, 66 passenger bus does not mean 66 kids on a bus any longer. And so we really have just decided to focus on some really specialty items for small groups within our facilities.
Do you have any guidance on whether sports activities will be okay to do?
Well, I think as you look at what the governor's guidelines are, small groups are allowed as long as we can socially distance. And we are going to do the best we can to allow kids some experience as far as, again, physical play and games. But we are not, as a YMCA, for example, moving towards any of what would typically be like our spring or summer sports programs, things like that. Those group activities aren't going to continue, at least at this point in time. But the summer program, some of those things that the kids are, and even a good example of tennis, and where you can do some activities around one-on-one and distance that way. And sometimes it's just catch or frisbee and some of those game plays that again, allow kids to be spread out a little bit more than they normally would be. And again, our goal is to keep them as socially distanced as we possibly can. But we also know that kids are kids. And so it's, they're not living with in a bubble either and stuff. And so we'll do the best we can. We also, in that light, is we know that we share equipment and things like that. We make sure it's sanitized regularly. Even our groups, because they will share gym space, for example, we don't do two groups at one time in a space. And so that when a group goes in there and may play basketball, for example, where kids are separating themselves and using each basket and sharing or each having their own equipment, when the next group comes in, we actually sanitize the equipment, sanitize the space, and the next group then can come in and use each of those baskets and each of that equipment. So we do have some very strict protocols in place. And our goal is what we recognize is we're trying to mitigate the risk. We know that, again, COVID-19 is out there, and until there's a vaccine, there's always going to be some level of risk.
Yeah. Dave, I was kind of just wondering, as the parent of a school-age kid, what you're telling staff about how the kids can be together. I mean, small groups are definitely sound like, you know, an important step, but anyone who's around kids knows that they're just like on each other all the time.
Yeah.
Is there a plan?
Well, and again, I think that our plan is that parents understand the risk that they're also taking a little bit. We are going to do the best we can. We keep, again, the kids as isolated as we can be, the small groups. But you're right, kids will be kids. They're not living with the little bit of the joke is a noodle around their head that keeps them far enough away or, you know, 6 feet away from every kid at every moment. And that's just impossible. And so we are upfront with parents. They recognize that. They know that there is some inherent risk with the kids being close to each other. But there is no specific six-foot barrier. Our goal is to keep them as separate as we possibly can. But also that's why we do the small groups, so that groups aren't cross-contaminating. Even staff aren't cross-contaminating from one group to the other, so that if, God forbid, there is some sort of outbreak or response, that we've isolated it within itself, and so that the groups aren't, again, cross-contaminating one another. But we've been doing this now for 10 weeks. We have not had an instance at all. You know, we also do a health check before everybody comes into our programs, as you'll see. And not only is it a simple asking of certain questions of, have you been around anybody or exposed to anybody with COVID-19? We do a temperature check. We do a health screening. Are you showing any signs of or symptoms of fever, cough, a series of things, just to make sure that before they even enter our programs, we've lessened that chance for risk. And we do that for every participant, every parent that comes into the classrooms, any staff, any vendors, anybody that's preparing meal, all of that is done in as a safe manner as we possibly can.
Dave Morgan leads the YMCA of Greater Kalamazoo. Dave, good talking to you.
Good. Thank you. I appreciate it.
While the picture is clearing for day camps this summer, it's entirely a different matter for the state's sleepaway camps, the kind of places where, in other times, Michigan childhood magic is made. Jake Jacobs is the director of Camp Henry in Newaygo. Jake, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
So on a scale of 1 to 10, if 10 were a typical year, everything right on schedule, and finances looking fully solvent, and if we consider that one would be no camp at all in session, where is Camp Henry right now?
Well, that's a great question. It feels a little bit like a yo-yo. You could ask me that question again in 5 minutes and my number might change.
Right.
There's moments of great optimism and other moments where it feels like we're just pushing a rock uphill and we're wondering if we're ever going to get to the peak. But I think today I'm more optimistic than maybe I was last week. There's been some good positive momentum. So, and we're hanging in there. We're going to continue to pursue all options until we exhaust all options to serve kids at camp. You know, I think certainly everybody has the safety of kiddos and staff at the forefront of their focus. So sometimes I think that just requires maybe an extra level of review or a new set of eyes. And I think also one of the things that I've noticed is we're bringing people into that decision-making process that might be public health experts or medical professionals, and some may and some may not have a great sense of what a camp experience is like. So a little bit of is getting them up to speed on just what a typical camp experience is like and how some of their recommendations and best practices would really play out in a summer camp setting.
Well, we have been hearing repeatedly that sleepaway camps are awaiting guidance. What does that mean? Who are you looking toward right now?
We're glad to be partnering with the state licensing, LARA, in the state of Michigan. You know, they're the ones that provide us with a license to be able to operate and serve kiddos. And there's a work group that's been put together that's working with state licensing and some policy advisors in the governor's office. And I've actually been one of the, 12 or 15 camp directors throughout the state that's been asked to be a part of that work group. You know, my understanding is, you know, day camp's recommendations came out yesterday, which was great. And I think the word is there's a draft of those resident camp guidelines that are in the works. And I think they hope to share those with this work group early next week.
What kind of recommendations did you bring up as the group advising Governor Whitmer was meeting?
Well, you know, I think I'm obviously highly biased, not only as a camping professional, but as a dad of three kiddos. But just pointing out that I think kids are going to be getting outdoors. They're going to be connecting with other kids. And, you know, kids just really need for their social and emotional and mental health to be out and gathering and connecting. And, you know, my point of view is, wouldn't you rather have that happen in a camp setting where they're really well supervised, that there are structured activities, that there are often, as there are at Camp Henry, health staff on site 24 hours a day. And in many ways, I think the week that a kid would spend at camp is probably going to be the safest week of their summer.
How so?
Well, if a kid's at home, they're likely not going to have that structure. They're likely not going to be as well supervised. They probably won't have someone monitoring their symptoms and taking their temperature each day. So, you know, camps have been in the business of mitigating risk and taking care of kiddos since camps have been in existence. And so it's something that we're good at. And I think we can provide, you know, a really safe environment as long as we're thoughtful when we go about doing it.
You know, we asked an epidemiologist about a week ago, who was also a dad, what he thinks about school in the fall. Now, granted, this was a different thing that we were asking him. We were asking him about a situation where kids would be indoors all the time and the relative safety. If he thinks that school in the fall is going to be possible in the way that we understand it. And he actually said that he's concerned that we don't understand enough about how the virus and some related conditions work in kids right now. What kind of medical advice are you getting?
Well, a lot, that's for sure. And, you know, depending on who you ask, I wouldn't say you get wildly differing opinions, but like you mentioned, things are evolving so quickly that the advice is changing, and just our knowledge of how to mitigate risks and how to care for kiddos is changing. I think some of the things that we're hearing that are pretty clear is outdoors is better than indoors, and smaller groups are better than bigger groups. A lot of camps like us are in a fortunate situation where we can plan almost all, if not every program or activity or meal to take place outdoors, which will certainly, from everything we heard, increase safety and reduce the risks. And also just keeping kids in smaller groups and in intact groups and with the same leaders and being consistent with that. And then, of course, just tons of hand washing and sanitizing hands. And, you know, a lot of these are practices that camps have had in place for years, but certainly a heightened focus and emphasis on it this year.
Right. Can you take us through a typical day at Camp Henry and what might look different this year, aside from the outdoor meals?
Yeah, well, we always joke when people ask what's a typical day at camp, we say there is no such thing, which is part of the joy and the adventure of being in the camping business. But, you know, I think to your question of what might look different is we're going to be really intentional working behind the scenes as we put activities and programs and schedules together to keep those kids from mixing with other groups, but doing so in a way that hopefully doesn't become a distraction from the camp experience. I think really the differences are those large group gatherings are either going to have to happen exclusively outdoors, they'll have to happen with kids in their individual groups, but those individual groups spread out from the other individual groups. We might have to do things multiple times. So whether it's meals or large group events or games or campfires, doing them either multiple times throughout the day so we can reduce the number of kiddos, or multiple locations throughout camp. For instance, you know, an opening campfire that we might have 250 people around, well, that might turn into five campfires with 50 people at five different locations.
How does all this affect your staffing situation?
Well, they have lots of questions as well, as do their parents. I think one of the things that has benefited us, we made the decision over a couple months ago that we wanted to honor our staff that had already signed on and committed to us for the summer. So we communicated with them that even if we had to cancel our entire summer, we were going to commit to pay them 50% of their summer pay. We're asking these folks to commit to us. And we just felt like, gosh, if it gets close to the start of summer camp and we're in a position where we're either not able to open, or the state hasn't allowed us to open yet, or we have to cancel, that would just be a really crummy position to put those folks in and say, hey, sorry, we don't have a job, and also good luck finding a job in this environment. So I think the fact that we made that decision about 2.5 months ago has been really helpful. I know as I've talked to some of my colleagues that are canceling or closing camp, that's one of the leading reasons, is they just don't feel like they are able to commit to their staff, and they don't want to cut it too close. And so they're trying to free them up before their summer camp season starts. We've also doubled the length of our staff training, just because we know we're going to be doing things a little bit differently. We keep talking about this summer is going to feel like we're operating left-handed. Just not quite the same, not quite as comfortable, but certainly it's something that we can adapt to and that we can practice and that we can get better. But having that additional week of training will certainly help.
Jake, thanks so much. We wish you luck and hope you're able to at least provide some experiences for the kids this year.
Yeah, well, thanks. We do too. And I just, like I said before, I really think kids need camp now more than ever. They've suffered so many disappointments and they've lost out on so many opportunities. And certainly safety is at the top of the list, but I'm convinced that, you know, camp folks are creative. We always have been, and this is just another opportunity for us to step up and find a way to be creative and keep kids safe, but provide them with these experiences that I think they really need.
Jake Jacobs is the director of Camp Henry in Newaygo. Jake, take care.
Thanks so much.
After the break, as massive protests against police use of force take place across Michigan, there are hundreds of people being arrested.
They are being arrested without any semblance of due process.
In a moment, we'll speak with a lawyer about who is being arrested and what happens to them. Stick around. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The sight of thousands of people in the streets of cities like Detroit and Grand Rapids is unprecedented since perhaps the 1960s. As you've no doubt seen on social media, some protesters have been arrested. We were curious to find out what's been happening to them. Julie Hurwitz joins us today. She's vice president of the Detroit office of the National Lawyers Guild. Julie, welcome to Stateside.
Thanks for having me.
Could you hazard a guess at roughly how many people have been taken into custody since last weekend?
Well, from our count and the calculation we've been able to do up till now, we believe anywhere between 200 and 300 people have now been arrested.
Can you walk us through what's happening with them? Are they being processed the same as other people who were taken into custody for different kinds of offenses?
Not even close. To start with, the entire method of arresting most of the people who've been picked up has been entirely unprecedented. People are being swooped up off the street simply for being there, simply for filming what other officers are doing, simply for just being in a particular location. And all of them who have been issued misdemeanor tickets are being, the tickets, what we've learned, have all been pre-written, which means it has nothing to do with what anybody actually did. Kind of reminiscent of that film, The Minority Report. The process itself, people are being handcuffed. They're being physically assaulted both before and after their arrests. They're being herded onto buses. Some people have been sitting on buses for upwards of 3 to 4 hours at a time. They are then being, and several of the people who've been arrested have suffered injuries, and their injuries are being ignored by the police to a large extent. They are being taken either to Little Caesars Arena to be processed, ticketed, and then released, or several of them are being taken up to the Detroit Detention Center over on Mound Road. I believe those are the people who've had to post some kind of a bond. Those people are not being brought into the Detroit Detention Center. They're simply being processed out in the parking lot and then ticketed, either post their bond or not, and released, and then just left. So we have an amazing group of coalition of folks from the National Lawyers Guild, the Bail Project, and Michigan Liberation, who have been able to get out to the Mound Road facility to be able to help people post bond who don't have the money, help people get transportation, and help people get back connected to the people they need to reconnect with.
Do you know what determines whether or not bond will be must be posted or whether or not charges will be filed?
Well, the difference between bond being posted and charges being filed are two different things. And we haven't quite figured out why some people are being required to post bond and others haven't. It could have to do with the decision of the officers who arrested them. Whether or not charges are actually going to be filed or people are going to actually be prosecuted at this point remains to be seen.
Is that a decision that's made within the prosecutor's office?
On misdemeanor charges, I think a lot's going to depend on whether these tickets are actually turned over to the prosecutor's office by the Detroit Police Department.
What stands in the way of that at this point?
Good question.
You're saying that the tickets have not really been made public either to prosecutors or to the defendants themselves.
No, the tickets. Everyone who's been arrested is getting a copy of the ticket. Some people have court dates on those tickets. I've seen in past experience with political protesters who've been arrested, they'll get a ticket, they'll get a court date, they'll show up in court, and there will be no record of them in the court.
Wow. So it's, I mean, I'm sort of getting the sense that at least some of this may be a function of overwhelm within the system.
Well, certainly overreaction, I would say. The response by the Detroit Police Department to the peaceful exercise of First Amendment rights by the vast majority of people who are taking a stand against the legacy and history of institutional racism and police violence in this country has been astounding. Some of the footage that I've seen of the police response to people simply walking in the street and the level of violence, the level of blatantly unconstitutional behavior on the short little snippets I've seen has been quite unbelievable and outrageous. I've been a civil rights lawyer since 1982, and I have seen a lot of police misconduct in my time, and I have rarely seen anything as blatantly unconstitutional as what I've been seeing out on the streets these past 5 days.
Julie, we heard that Tristan Taylor, an organizer at the heart of the Detroit protest movement, is being held without charge right now. Have you heard anything about his case?
I have heard that he's been arrested. I know that there is talk of him being charged with a felony. I believe it might be something along the lines of inciting to riot. I was, again, outraged to read a description of the arrests that happened last night. One of our legal observers, by the way, Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib, was out there and described that there was nothing violent or riotous going on at the time the decision was made to arrest. And I saw a quote from Chief Craig today in which he mentioned that he refers to this not being a peaceful protest, but the only basis he gave for that was that they were out there after the curfew, a curfew that should never have been in place to begin with.
What kind of services can the Guild and the folks who you're working with, what kind of services can you provide for the folks who've been arrested?
We are have joined forces with a number of organizations that I'm so proud to say is just unbelievable. Along with the National Lawyers Guild, the Detroit Justice Center, the National Conference of Black Lawyers, the Neighborhood Defender Services of Detroit, and the Wayne County Criminal Defense Bar have been recruiting volunteer lawyers since Saturday. We now have over 127 lawyers who have stepped forward to volunteer their services pro bono to step in and undertake complete and total representation of every person who's been arrested as a result of these protests.
Is it enough?
we're getting more by the day. I hope it's enough. I believe it will be enough. I've been representing civil disobedience and political protesters for many decades now as well, and have never seen a level of response by the legal community, a multiracial, multi-political, coordinated effort to make sure that the rights of the people who were wrongfully arrested are going to be fully and vigorously defended.
I heard what you said, that in past cases you have seen people who've taken part in protests go through a legal process that's anything but the norm. Would you say that to this point, the folks who you've helped who have been arrested are getting due process?
The folks who are participating in these anti-police brutality protests?
Yes.
Oh, I would say the exact opposite is occurring. I believe that they are being arrested without due process at all. They are being arrested without any semblance of due process.
Julie, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
We've been talking with Julie Hurwitz, Vice President of the Detroit Office of the National Lawyers Guild. Since we spoke with Julie Hurwitz, reporters covering the protests and arrests have received word that organizer Tristan Taylor has been released from custody. He will not be charged with a felony for his involvement in the protests. Marcel Price, known around the community as Fable, is the poet laureate of Grand Rapids. He's also the executive director of the Diatribe, a youth-focused performing arts nonprofit in Grand Rapids. Through his organization, he put out a statement about the protests in Michigan and beyond. It read to us more like an essay, or dare we say poetry. Here's Marcel with his thoughts on this moment in America.
I'd like to start by first stating that organizations like the Diatribe are in a very dangerous situation. Honestly, this weekend I've been very vocal on my personal social media pages, but almost completely silent on our organization's page. Because, well, white supremacy and racism. What do I mean by that? Well, the answer to that isn't simple. It's just as complex as the events that transpired this weekend, but I'll try to break it down in a way that makes more sense. When a black man is murdered at the hands of our law enforcement in a neighboring city that isn't unsimilar to Grand Rapids, when a black woman is slain in her home by the hands of the same congregation in a different state, and to top that off, a black man locally is brutalized so badly that when you look at his picture, you can't help but to cry. When all of this happens, on top of opening your eyes to the fact that our city is the second worst economically for black people, that students in our urban core have had full-time subs in some of their classes for multiple years in a row, as our teachers are expected to provide more to our young people with less, in a city with a zip code that has kids in the 49507 testing with lead levels as high as Flint, with an infant mortality rate so staggering you actually feel attacked by the data, we are creating a social time bomb that is ready to explode. You see, in Grand Rapids, we live in an echo chamber. We know gentrification exists. We have documentaries covering gentrification in our city, but many prefer the new residents and the new businesses over doing the labor to improve the quality of life for those that have always called this city their home and have always seen it as valuable. Living in this bubble makes watching people scrub the words, names of dead people off of the walls painful, as residents are quicker to erase the literal writing on the wall than they are to seek justice for black people that have been brutalized or even murdered. But when people snap, when they get fed up and can't take anymore, they are told that hate is winning. They are told to be quiet. They are told to take more, and they are told anger will not solve anything by the very people perpetuating these issues. And I'm not saying rioting is the answer. I will say
The anger is a healthy emotion, as is sadness. I will say that for every fair housing movement and peaceful protests, there was a Detroit riot. That for every equal marriage law passed, there was a Stonewall. So to assume that there's one finite way to solve an issue that is rooted in Black people being quiet, complacent, and continuing to stomach mistreatment is not only selfish, but it's racist. I think there are levels to allyship. There are people who say Black Lives Matter, and there are people who mean it. When some people say Black Lives Matter, what they mean is the Black lives behaving the way I want them to behave matter. When some people say Black Lives Matter, what they mean is the Black lives that haven't done things I disagree with matter. I encourage you to say Black Lives Matter and mean all Black lives, Black Christians, Black felons, Black trans folks, and the Black atheists, Black artists, Black families, and Black single parents, Black business owners, and the displaced Black people residing in your downtown, the Black lives who riot, and the ones who are peaceful all deserve to live. Period. If you are choosing to employ officers that are brutalizing or murdering our residents, you care more about white supremacy than you do about Black people, period. We would also like to acknowledge those that are striving for better than C-plus allyship. The people who I saw downtown this weekend pouring milk in the eyes of those being tear gassed. The allies who are putting their bodies in front of those being shot with rubber bullets and putting their bodies on the line to protect Black existence. This allyship is truly rare. So thank you for that. And I hope others will be inspired by your bravery. But before we focus on crucifying those for lashing out, we need to dissect why lashing out is being done in the first place. If people are peacefully protesting, they should be peacefully arrested, period. If the brutality stops, if the murders stop, if we actually focus on combating racism, if we work to make our city culturally rich, and if we truly celebrate diversity to a point where our residents are proud to call this city their home while thinking of downtown as their own, I believe events like this won't happen. We fixed up downtown in a day when we have businesses on the southeast and southwest side with urine and broken windows that have been asking for support for years. People don't try to break systems that aren't broken. But maybe our systems are working just as they were designed to. So help us break it by prioritizing the areas that are being ignored. As an arts and education organization, in a time where the future of education is uncertain and arts and cultural programs are being cut, we see our work as even more important. Teaching young people the history that is often left out of textbooks and encouraging them not only to write about the things they see going on in the world in their communities, but to take action and to unpack the personal and collective trauma in a safe and culturally responsible way. So today, tomorrow, and the next day, I want you to say their names. Breonna Taylor, who is from Grand Rapids. Kavassier Phillips. George Floyd. I want you to look them up. I want you to learn their stories. Ask yourself, next month, if this is me, if this is one of our students, or any other Grand Rapidian, what will we do? Is continuing to live as if it didn't happen and erasing the ugly reminders what you call progress? Also, what are we willing to do to ensure that this does not happen again?
That's Marcel Fable Price, Poet Laureate of Grand Rapids. You can learn more about the work of his youth-focused performing arts nonprofit, The Diatribe, at thediatribe.org. That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thanks for listening. We'll catch you tomorrow.